It is Tuesday, April 30th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The Fayetteville Dixon Street Spring Fest is Saturday, beginning at 7 a.m. Events include the annual bed races, a pancake breakfast, the Artisphere Trail Mix concert, a dog parade and children's events, live music, and more. Information and an event schedule are available on the web at FayettevilleSpringFest.com.
Ahead on Ozarks, a big check from Tyson Foods to the Springdale Public Schools Education Foundation. Grammy-winning John Legend speaks in Fayetteville. The Fort Smith Symphony tunes up for the season finale, and all kinds of theater magic all over the place on tap for May. That and more ahead.
But first, today, the Army Corps of Engineers and the Beaver Lake Foundation officially begin a partnership meant to benefit all lake users. Sean Harper, the Corps' operations manager for Beaver Lake, says the foundation will be able to offer additional resources, such as fundraising and attracting volunteers to help with projects at the lake.
You know, our budget is fairly fixed. It's certainly not increasing in any kind of a way. So, you know, we've got an aging infrastructure. We've got parks on Beaver Lake that are, you know, they're approaching 50 years old in just a few years. And a lot of this stuff just needs a lot of TLC. And with our decreased buying power through the federal budget process, we're looking for partners that can help us. The most important thing is that we have facilities on Beaver Lake that are, you know, they're accessible, they're safe to use, that they meet the needs of the public. And, you know, we're reaching out to a partner like Beaver Lake Foundation to help us make sure that we reach that, that we're able to sustain that here at Beaver Lake.
Harper says an example of a project the partnership could help with is the creation of life jacket stations at every beach on the lake. He says although the Corps was able to find enough money to build one last year and possibly two this year, the partnership with the Beaver Lake Foundation has the potential of doubling the Corps' construction capability.
It's beyond our capability within our own budget to just take all that on at one time. The foundation has indicated that they have an interest in maybe trying to do some fundraising and to acquire some funds and maybe some volunteer folks who could help both acquire and then construct these. And then the partnership, the Corps has the equipment to go and actually, you know, drill the holes and install these life jacket loaner stations out there above the beaches. So that's kind of the partnership effort on that particular case. The foundation has indicated they're going to try to do that, raise some money, get these things built, and then the Corps will take them and go install them.
More generally speaking, though, the goal of the Beaver Lake Foundation is to support the Corps' operations and recreation at the lake. The formal agreement between the two entities is being signed today.
10,000 new recipients of the Arkansas Academic Challenge were notified they had been awarded the scholarship yesterday. This class of recipients will be the first to be subject to new rules regarding the lottery scholarship that was passed by the 89th General Assembly. Act 234 of 2013 set into place a tiered award system where incoming freshmen receiving the scholarship at four-year institutions are awarded $2,000 their first year, $3,000 their sophomore year, $4,000 during their junior year, and finally $5,000 during their senior year. Attendees of two-year schools will receive $2,000 each year. Johnny Key, a state senator from Mountain Home, was one of the proponents of the change payouts. At the time of the law's discussion in the legislature, he said the change was necessary to keep the lottery scholarship system solvent.
We were on an unsustainable course that we were paying out more money than we were taking in through the lottery. The reason that we've been able to do that up to this point was because of the first 7 months of sales of the lottery tickets created about an $80 million reserve before we started awarding scholarships. That reserve has been spent down, and we had to fix the solvency issue going forward.
The new payout scheme will not affect previous recipients of the scholarship. In addition, according to a release issued by the Arkansas Department of Higher Education, nearly 6,000 scholarship applications have been started, but the potentially eligible students have not completed the process. Students have until June 1st to submit completed applications to be considered for the lottery scholarship.
The port at Helena is receiving its first permanent tenant since its creation in 1993. Envirotech Chemical Solutions plans to bring 73 jobs to the site by 2015, at which time it will consider expanding the operation to 150 workers. State Representative John Edwards has been involved in the port's decision to focus on attracting smaller businesses.
There are a lot more smaller businesses out there than there are the big 500 job employers. Now, everybody wants to land the big 500 job employer, but there's just not that many of those out there in the grand scheme of things.
Phil Harvey, a vice president with EnviroTech, pointed toward Helena's ability to adequately staff and operate the facility.
The workforce has been fantastic so far. Everybody has been extremely easy to work with, very driven. And, you know, we have had our problems, just like everyone else, with what we have to offer. We've had great success with hiring out in eastern Arkansas and western Mississippi.
EnviroTech's planned arrival will generate new jobs for the Port Authority and increase revenues collected throughout the community.
This year's Starlight Gala for the Northwest Arkansas Children's Shelter raised the bar once again. 1,300 people attended the event last Friday at the John Q. Hammond Center in Rogers. It was announced that it raised $520,000 for the shelter, above and beyond the $435,000 raised at last year's event. The amount raised this year represents close to 16% of the shelter's $3.3 million budget for the year. The gala is the shelter's largest annual fundraiser, netting about three times as much as any other fundraiser throughout the year.
With a millage election coming in mid-September, officials with Bentonville Public Schools are hosting a number of public forums to get residents' feedback on the millage proposal. The forums will include a minimum of one school board member and one school district central administrator. Tonight, a forum is scheduled for 7:45 at Mary Mae Jones Elementary, and another forum will be tomorrow at Apple Glen Elementary. Additional forums are scheduled through May 15th. A complete schedule of public forums can be found on the district's website at bentonvillek12.org.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals closed a four-game series in Tulsa last night with an 8-2 loss against the Drillers. The loss, the third in the series for the Nats, and the team is now 8-16 on the year. The Naturals return to Arvest Ballpark tonight to open up a four-game series against the Springfield Cardinals.
Mostly clear tonight with lows from 58 in northwest Arkansas to 62 in the Arkansas River Valley. Mostly sunny tomorrow with highs in the lower 80s. And tomorrow night, there is a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms after midnight with lows from 49 in northwest Arkansas to 53 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley.
This is Ozarks at Large. The 28 schools in the Springdale School District will likely benefit from a large gift yesterday made at Tyson Foods headquarters in Springdale.
We're here today to announce a $100,000 grant to the Springdale Public Schools Education Foundation.
The $100,000 grant is intended to help the two-year-old Springdale Public Schools Education Foundation grow. A portion will be used to help the foundation's operating expenses. $70,000 will be directed toward grants over the next 2 years for classroom and school-wide projects. Chris Steckline, the executive director of the foundation, says the first year the foundation raised about $20,000, mainly from the voluntary payroll deductions of district employees. Chris Steckline says he went to teachers with a vision to help get the foundation started.
And said, if you'll support us, here's what we'll do. We're going to do. We hadn't done anything when we asked them for money. And our ask is simple. We ask people to consider $10 per pay period, $120 per year. And with that, we'll fund these grants.
The initial $20,000 raise did help fund projects. Josh Worthy is the EAST facilitator at Sonora Elementary School. EAST stands for Environmental and Spatial Technology. His students, a few more than 100 of them, develop programs to create maps using GIS technology. Last year, his students were able to host a Technology with Nature camp. A grant facilitated through the foundation allowed him to purchase high-end GPS units. Yesterday, he explained one of the ways his students have used those devices.
Kids are using those exact same Trimbles this year to help plot and map an old cemetery in a neighborhood close to our school building. It's at Blue Springs Village, and it's kind of a forgotten cemetery. There's about 17 grave markers, but many of those grave markers are from World War I, World War II veterans. There's also some tombstones that are just river rocks that look like they've been carried up from Beaver Lake, whereas at that time it was White River. They're really smooth. There's not any indentions on them. So the kids have plotted the GPS coordinates from the satellite, and they are creating an interactive map that shows the biography of those people.
Each of the GPS units cost about $1,000 each, something he says the school district would have not been able to afford without the grant money. The school has created a partnership with the Center for Advanced Spatial Technologies, or CAST, at the University of Arkansas to help with the GPS machinery. Josh says these kinds of class activities, the EAST classes, reach about 1 in 6 at his elementary school, broaden the way students learn.
You know, we're only in our second year, but we've charted our test scores, and believe it or not, especially for our kids, mathematics has increased, but literacy skills have gone through the roof, and I think it just deals with the problem-solving skills, the basic problem-solving skills you learn from EAST. I think education's due for a big change. We haven't seen a really big change in education since maybe the 1950s. And we're going to have to step away from textbooks and pencil and paper. It's going to go to the iPad and the use of the internet and technology and working in community projects. I think that's the biggest thing that you take out of grade school and you know, middle school is working together as a team, because you have to, that carries over into real life.
Chris Steckline, the executive director of the Springdale Public Schools Education Foundation, says the program, like the one created through the Sonora Elementary School, is exactly what the foundation wants to be able to fund. He says the ideas are always there, the money isn't always.
On average, and the number's been pretty consistent for years now, on average, a teacher spends about $500 out of their own pocket funding their classroom. And, you know, that's not acceptable. And so, yeah, our intent is to find the gray space and be able to fund the projects that work in the gray space. The one thing that I can say without any hesitation is, as I've worked in lots of different schools, lots of different school districts, I've never been in one who had more money than they needed.
Supporters of the Springdale Public Education Foundation say yesterday's $100,000 grant from Tyson Foods is not a finish line, but they hope a catalyst to encourage more financial commitments. Mike McFarland, the board chair of the foundation, says he thinks the high-profile announcement yesterday can help build the foundation's coffers.
We've done things that make a difference to somebody like the EAST program. We've done a ukulele program. So, you know, it's surprising. It's almost like we do the full gamut, and not only being able to help an EAST school, but somebody with ukulele. So that's pretty neat. That's A to U, I guess.
In addition to the classroom grants, the foundation says it also manages nearly $450,000 in a half dozen scholarship funds. You can learn more about the foundation at spsef.org.
Last night, John Legend, a Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter, spoke at Barnhill Arena as part of the University of Arkansas's Distinguished Lecture Series. Legend, whose given name is John Rogers Stevens, has sold millions of albums worldwide during the past decade. And although he is an accomplished musician, he is also a social activist. Prior to his public lecture, he spoke to media about his decision to focus on the issue of education as part of his philanthropic endeavors. Legend says he grew up in a household where education was a high priority. His parents homeschooled him for several years, and Legend says his parents really believed that education was critical. So they spent a lot of personal time and energy trying to prepare him best for life. Legend says even after his parents divorced, the foundation that they set up helped carry him through high school, where he was one of the top students in his class. After graduation, he attended the University of Pennsylvania, an Ivy League school.
I definitely credit my parents for placing that emphasis, early on in my life and helping set me up to be successful in school. But I also went to a public school from 8th through 12th grade, and my high school, only about half the kids graduated from high school on time. I talk about that in my speech, and I didn't really even realize that when I was there, how much smaller the class got from freshman year to senior year. I just kind of figured, oh, they must have gone to another school or something. I didn't really realize that a lot of people were just dropping out of school. And this is an issue in a lot of schools around the country. And if that's happening, we know that those young people are not going to be prepared for all the challenges that life gives them. They won't have a lot of options for their future. A lot of them get caught up in the criminal justice system. Some of my peers and some of my kids in my neighborhood and family members did that and got locked up for various reasons. And all of these things happen in part due to the fact that people's options are limited when their education does not prepare them for success. And so I care about that, and I want that to be something we focus on as a society. And so that's why I focus on this issue.
While Legend's music career has given him a platform to reach a lot of people, he says change can come from an individual.
I think solving the overall problem will take a lot of people, but I've seen a lot of big change happen from individuals that were willing to do things that were bold. I look at friends and colleagues of mine, like Wendy Kopp, who founded Teach for America, who decided when she was in college, wrote about it in college as her senior thesis, that something like Teach for America should be founded. And then she went out and did it. This is somebody who was an individual in college, the same age as a lot of the kids that will be here today, who decided to do something big and exciting. I met people who decided maybe a little later in life, but have made a big change in people's lives because they decided to commit to this subject. People who have founded schools, people who have fought for change in school districts, and every person that's doing that is affecting dozens of kids and making communities better. And so I think that's a great thing. And if I encourage anybody to do that today, then it will be, you know, moving the ball forward.
Legend says there are a lot of things that need to be done to help improve education, such as making strong pre-K programs available for all kids. Legend says this could help narrow the gap between rich and poor when it comes to educational outcomes. He cited a recent article in the New York Times that shows how the gap between rich and poor students has grown in the last 30 years.
A lot of that has to do with the fact that rich parents have way more access to the kinds of things that help their kids be better prepared to be successful in school and to be successful in life. And those advantages have grown over time. And only way that we can close that gap is if we start to look at what's working for kids that have more means and then deciding as a society that we can do more to close that gap. One of those issues is making sure there's pre-K, also finding options for daycare for parents so that they have the ability to spend so that their kids have more adult supervision and more quality time with adults. But also we need to make sure that we empower our principals and our superintendents to make sure that every classroom and every school has quality teachers in every classroom. And that takes some policy changes as well. Up and down the system, we need to figure out what's working and what's not working, how do we fix it, and not be afraid to go in there and fix it. Because I think what we've gotten stuck doing is kind of adhering to the status quo on so many issues when the status quo is so clearly not working out for so many people.
The Distinguished Lecture Series speakers are chosen by a committee of students, faculty, and staff. The events are funded by a student-approved fee appropriated by the Programs Allocation Board. More information is available at uark.edu.
California farmers take the promises of immigration reform with a grain of salt.
It'll help us in the short term. The long term remains to be seen.
Migration patterns are changing, and many farmers have seen reform before.
We thought we solved it in 1986, right? And here we are again.
A future farm labor shortage later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, this afternoon beginning at 3 on KUAF.
The following is the first of hopefully many installments of stories based on entries from the Encyclopedia of Arkansas, a project of the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies at the Central Arkansas Library System in Little Rock. We start with gold prospecting in the Ozarks. Ozarks at-largest Jacqueline Froelich takes us up to a parcel of land in Rogers, the site of an early 20th century gold mine.
We're standing in the drizzly rain on the periphery of Rogers Heritage High School. But once upon a time, back when this place was farmland, more than a century ago, a man named William Cruz believed he had struck gold, enough gold to save the world, right here on this spot.
Well, I think a lot of people at the time thought he was a bit of a whack job because he believed there was gold because he'd had a vision that there was gold.
Rogers Historical Museum Director Gabe Bland has chronicled gold prospector William Cruz in talks and special exhibitions at her museum.
He actually lived in Minneapolis for most of his life, his connection with Rogers was that his parents had moved down here and they bought a farm. So he would come down here and visit. And they, you know, he had sisters who were down here who'd married some of the local businessmen. So that's how he got to be connected with Rogers. And that's what his vision was about an apple tree on his father's farm that had gold underneath it.
And he fully expected to strike the proverbial mother lode. Gabe Land pulls out a newspaper Cruz published about his venture with the masthead Sunshine and Truth, wherein Cruz details his mining parameters.
And his vision was that the shaft should be 16 feet square to a depth of 7 feet. And the second 7 feet was the beginning of the gold-bearing dirt, and then they were to go down 7 feet more, and so they followed those instructions. So it was a fairly large area down, it sounds like, about 14 feet he was going. And he was digging up dirt and rock, which he, you know, they sacked up and then and put on the trip to the railroad car up to St. Louis.
Where the ore was assayed, more about that in a minute, the Cruz gold mine required a lot of hands, so William advertised for help.
And he actually runs an ad in the local newspaper, wanted at Cruz Gold Mine Wednesday, October 18th. Ladies to prepare and serve free lunch to laborers and musicians, 10. 40 men to drive teams, load and unload wagons and scrapers, 10 teams for the wagons and scrapers. Paying $2 a day for 6 hours of work for the men. For a man and a team, $4 per day, 6 hours work, and $1 for the ladies to prepare and serve lunch. And so it was a grand opening. And what they did, apparently, that day, October 18th, 1905, the Rogers Cornet Band led a procession from downtown out to the gold mine. And they marched around the field, and then they finally settled in at work at the hole where he said the gold was to be located and really started digging in earnest. And so he was back and forth over the years, continuing to work on and off on the gold mine, eventually built some buildings out there. But every time he sent ore up to St. Louis on the Frisco Railroad, it ended up being dumped because the professional assayers up there said there's not, if there's any gold in here, it's not enough that it would be productive, be profitable. And he kept arguing, no, I know better than you. I've assayed it myself, and I know it's really good stuff. So that was the problem for him. He couldn't get anybody to accept that it really was enough gold there to make it profitable.
Historically, gold's been mined in Bulgaria, India, South Africa, Spain, and Australia. In the United States, claims occurred on Alaska, Colorado, and the California Yukons. 19th century speculators believed veins of gold glittered under the Ozarks Plateau due to proximity of productive lead and zinc mining.
And back in the 1880s, they were looking for everything. And in the late summer of 1887, the local newspaper said that every man at a picnic at War Eagle had in his pocket a rock which he claimed contained some rare and valuable metal. And so there was a big, you know, enthusiasm in the 1880s, and then it kind of faded away. And then in 1899, the Prairie Creek Mining Company was looking for coal out east of Rogers. And the Rogers Mining Company was drilling for lead and zinc on the prairie west of Rogers. Down in Springdale, they had a mining company leasing land around the fairgrounds. So it was something that would sort of ebb and flow throughout this entire time. And then, of course, we get in the 1920s. Then in this area, they start drilling for oil everywhere and convinced there was a big operation out at Centerton. And they kept saying, oh, we're almost there. But they never really struck anything. And what encouraged them there was that a lot of people out in the western part of the county particularly have a certain amount of natural gas in their on their property. It'll show up in their water wells when they drill, and there used to be a few folks that actually were able to heat their chicken houses with natural gas, you know, from their property for a short period of time. So, if there's gas, there's got to be oil.
So whatever happened to gold visionary William Cruz?
Well, I mean, he really stays up in Minneapolis in business here. And back and forth, 1912, he came and erected a 100-foot-tall framework for a crude smelter. So he was going to try to smelt the ore himself. But I don't think there was much that ever came of that. And then 1925, he actually dies at the age of 65. And the newspaper here reported he was still working at the mine. There was a building there that had been destroyed the summer before by a windstorm, but he'd rebuilt it on a smaller scale. But, of course, his death was the end of the digging there.
And what are the odds that William Cruz ran into Coin Harvey, who built the utopian resort of Montanay, now submerged under Beaver Lake, just south of here?
Well, I mean, they had to have known one another. Cruz and Harvey, they're around at the same time, you know. I'm sure they ran into one another on the streets of Rogers, so it must have been an interesting conversation.
Bentonville native and UA graduate Robert Myers is a city planner for Urbana, Illinois, and serves as president of the Illinois Association of Historic Preservation Commissions. He's working on a manuscript about treasure hunting on the Ozarks, so he's been researching individuals such as William Cruz for his book. He says William Cruz was a man of his era.
Spiritualism and the supernatural and the occult really ruled the day. And it wasn't like it was in the background. I mean, it was like in the forefront of people's lives. And it was for the majority of people in the country, the majority of households, that was the way it was. You know, maybe they went to church on Sunday. In addition to that, they had this whole other world of supernaturalism in the occult. Magic, practical, everyday magic, you might call it, that helped guide them on their day-to-day lives. So over time, that has receded, but it's taken a long, long time. And I think it has to do originally with the Enlightenment, Enlightenment ideals of, you know, ration and reason over intuition and belief. But it's taken a long time to move throughout the country and went over people's minds. And you might say there's still a struggle even to this day.
Like for those of us who believe in astrology, for example, and those who, well, don't. But Robert Myers said for centuries, metaphysical means were used to map precious metals.
Until the development of geology as a science, which occurred beginning in the 1700s, but certainly in the early 1800s, that people went about it in a scientific way. But, you know, there were lots and lots of people who continued on with the old ways long after science came along. But I should say also that both treasure hunting and geology and prospecting, or I should say treasure hunting and prospecting, went hand in hand with fraud and deception and organized crime in a way. There were whole leagues of professional scam artists in America in the 1800s and early 1900s who regularly advertised in the newspaper that they would help people for a fee find lost objects, attract love, money, find buried treasure. In fact, in a lot of the big city newspapers, you might find an entire page of classified ads for clairvoyance, mediums, and mystics. And a lot of the ads would say that they would help people find buried treasure.
But William Cruz, a successful businessman, was not such a scoundrel. He never sold stock in his venture. And if he had struck gold, he planned to share the wealth with those less fortunate. The Cruz family farm and gold mining site was eventually sold to make way for a new Rogers Public High School in 1922. So what about prospecting for artifacts from William Cruz's prospecting? 7 years ago, the historic site was under excavation, construction for the new Heritage High School. The architectural firm Height Jackson Associates was in charge of the project. So we queried them. In an email for this story, President Brian Jackson said yes, he'd heard about the gold mining, but no, his crews never did come across any mine shafts, shovels, or ore. That's hard to say. But his crews did excavate what turned out to be the farm's original trash pit filled with old glass jars. Those are fun. And at the end of his note, Brian Jackson apologized for not having any exciting news to share about the Cruz gold mine site. Status quo, right? Gold, by the way, surging in the 2013 marketplace, valued at $1,454 an ounce. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can find out more about the Cruz Gold Mine in the Encyclopedia of Arkansas History and Culture, a free authoritative source of information about the rich history, geography, and culture of Arkansas. The site contains 3,200 entries, more than 4,200 pieces of media available at encyclopediaofarkansas.net. It is Tuesday, the final day of April 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Ann Schneider-Hayda.
With us is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And so we repeat ourselves, bemoaning the fact that it's going to be May.
In just a few hours.
Holy cow.
One of the best months of the year.
Not okay with this.
At least it's finally spring.
Right.
Yeah. And you can tell because it's time for the Rogers Farmers Market tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
7 to 1 near the intersection of Arkansas and Elm Streets in downtown Rogers. There's a spring carnival tomorrow for students at the university and anybody else who wants to wander in Fayetteville. Funnel cakes, corn dogs, fried Snickers.
Okay, I'm in.
I thought you would be. Inflatable obstacle course, dunk tank, English, gone. A face painter, balloon animals, 11:30 to 3:30 on the Union Mall, and it is free.
Hmm.
Also tomorrow night, the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks Market from 4 to 7 at, oddly enough, the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks in Fayetteville. And the UAFS Chamber Ensembles perform at 7:30 tomorrow night at UAFS 2nd Street in Fort Smith. And that, too, is
free.
Exactly.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. Still ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a roundup of theater for May in the region. And John Jetter, the conductor and music director for the Fort Smith Symphony, talks about the symphony's season finale. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, will present its season finale, a John Williams tribute concert, Saturday, May 18th at 7:30 p.m. at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. SONA musicians and singers will perform highlights from movies like Schindler's List, Star Wars, E.T., Jaws, Harry Potter, and more. Tickets available at 443-5600 or sonamusic.org.
So I was very excited last week because Wakarusa finally announced the stage lineup.
Yes, we had known who was going to be playing. We just didn't know when or where.
Exactly. So I got really excited and printed out all of the little schedules and started highlighting where I wanted to go. And I hope you have done the same.
Well, tell me what you have highlighted.
Well, somebody I'd like to recommend for people
is
Delta Ray. It's a 6 or 7 person group from like the Carolinas or Virginia, I can never remember. And I saw them at Harvest Festival, and they were on a really small stage, but the power went out. And instead of them freaking out, not being able to do anything, they just came down in the middle of the crowd and started doing an acoustic set, and they were fabulous because so many of them are talented vocalists.
Mm-hmm. So when will they be at Waka?
Well, they're playing twice.
Okay.
They're going to play early afternoon on Thursday and then early afternoon on Friday. I think, 2:30 on Thursday and 1 o'clock on Friday. Now, they're on the main stage at 1 o'clock Friday. But I would really recommend you grabbing them on Thursday if you can in a smaller setting, because I just think they're worth seeing in a smaller setting and up close and personal instead of just that large stage with just everybody everywhere.
Everything I'm doing between now and Wakarusa will be designed toward getting me to Wakarusa on Friday at 5.
Of Monsters and Men.
Yes, who will be in the revival tent.
They will.
And they're going to be playing for about an hour 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
They're from Iceland.
I'm very excited about this one. I was supposed to go to a concert in Kansas City,
yes,
and it sold out. So I am incredibly stoked to be able to see them here.
You can find out more at the Wakarusa website.
You can.
And now, tickets have gone fast, but...
But you can get tickets. We have a couple of ways for you to get them for free.
Yes.
We, KUAF, we are giving away a couple of tickets to a couple of events this summer. Rocklahoma, Thunder on the Mountain, and Wakarusa. You need to register for all of those separately, and it's real easy to do. Go to our website, KUAF.com, and in the right-hand corner, there's a section of giveaways, and you click fill out the form. Very simple. We will draw a winner for that soon. Also, KXUA, the University of Arkansas's student-run radio station, they are giving away 2 Wakarusa event passes, 1 camping pass, and a bag of Wakarusa items to a lucky winner. To enter, all you have to do is like KXUA on Facebook and follow them on Twitter for a schedule of when questions will be asked during several of the student radio shows this week. And each day through Friday, they'll have questions, and the complete rules are on Facebook. So a couple of ways for you to win some free tickets in case you haven't gotten them yet.
Speaking of KXUA, they were on a national program. They were mentioned on a national program.
Now radio for 400.
Fayetteville's KXUA boasts that it plays no music that has been on this publication's top 40 chart in the last 50 years. Christina.
What is Billboard?
Yes.
On Jeopardy last week.
Yes, it was very exciting. I think John Schlois is the way I found out about that. Our own John Schlois, he'd seen it and posted about it on Facebook. It's pretty cool.
You know how I found out about it?
Mm-mm.
Posting on Facebook, Brian Rochal, who used to work at KUAF, now lives in Alabama. He was quite excited and
Oh, that's funny. Well, I talked to a guy that works at the station because I wanted to know if they called ahead of time and to verify the question or anything like that. And he said no, it was a complete surprise to them. So surprise for everybody, or happy surprise, I suppose.
And this is not just the final day of April. It's also the last Tuesday of April. The last Tuesday of the month is a time when we set aside a few minutes to peer ahead at theater in the region for the next few weeks. In a moment, we'll listen into just a few minutes of rehearsal of the large cast preparing to take audiences underwater during Arts Live Theater's production of The Little Mermaid. First, a reminder of some other theater opportunities in May. Rogers Little Theater this weekend opens a 2-week run of Love, Loss, and What I Wore. The production is a collection of pieces from writer Eileen Beckerman, both monologue and ensemble, about women, clothing, and memories. RLT will host a special Mother's Day Pink Ribbon Brunch on Mother's Day, May 12th. You can learn more about the entire run at rogerslittletheater.org. Theater Squared's presentation of the Tony Award and Pulitzer Prize-winning musical Next to Normal resumes tomorrow night with a special performance hosted by the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences Psychiatric Research Institute. The musical will continue to be staged through May 12th. You can find out more at theater2.org. Late this month and into early June, the Fort Smith Little Theater will present Neil Simon's wistful romantic comedy, Barefoot in the Park. The play opened on Broadway 50 years ago and was, of course, made into a film in 1967 with a young Jane Fonda and a young Robert Redford.
Mr. Paul Bratter.
Yes.
And is Mrs. Bratter staying with you?
My mother? Mrs. Bratter, yes. Mr. and Mrs. Bratter.
How long will you be staying with us, Mr. Bratter?
6 days.
And nights?
It's a pleasure to have you at the Plaza.
The FSLT version of Barefoot in the Park opens May 30th and will last through June 8th. More details available at FSLT.org. Also in Fort Smith this month, 2 productions from the University of Arkansas Fort Smith Academy of the Arts. Singing in the Rain will be at Breedlove Auditorium 3 times this weekend, beginning with a matinee at 2 Saturday afternoon. Dr. Rosalie Walker-Russell, the executive director of the Academy, recently told me the crew has developed some interesting effects for the most famous scenes.
It's going to appear like it's raining. It really is going to...
Well, that's not quite an answer.
Well,
it's theater
some
magic.
Magical lighting and glitter. Yes,
okay.
We have a way to rain down glitter in certain light because glitter comes in all sorts of colors.
Sure.
And, you know, you do a little silver and a little gold, and before you know it, it looks like little raindrops coming down with magical lighting.
Nice.
And right down on the scene.
Singing in the Rain will be on stage at Breedlove at 2 and 7 Saturday and again 2 Sunday afternoon. Also at Breedlove this month is the UAFS Academy production of Once Upon a Mattress, May 17th through the 19th. More information about Singing in the Rain and Once Upon a Mattress at uafs.edu/academy.
I'll tell you a tale of the bottomless blue.
And it takes the starboard people.
Brave sailor, beware, cause a beacon's a-brewing.
In mysterious fathoms below.
Last night, the large cast, more than 40 actors, continued rehearsals for the Arts Live presentation of The Little Mermaid Jr. The production is the latest from what may be the region's most prolific company. A quick glance of the walls at the ALT home in Fayetteville shows a wide variety of plays in just the past few years, from other Disney-inspired works like Beauty and the Beast to more serious fare like The Diary of Anne Frank and a separate piece. Before rehearsal began last night, the rooms and hall of the ALT building sounded just like what you might imagine nearly 50 young actors would sound like. The Little Mermaid Jr. is directed by Julie Gable, and last night she had a few minutes before rehearsals to talk to me about directing 54 actors and 7 crew members.
We had so many fabulous children audition that we were going to keep it to a much lower number, but there was so much talent that it was really hard to say no.
When you do a production like Little Mermaid, you know, if you go out there in the wall, you see things like Little Mermaid, Cinderella, but you also see Anne Frank and, you know, things like that. Is there any sort of different approach? I mean, is a play a play? Is a play?
Well, when I think you approach each script differently, of course, depending on the needs and if it's a drama, if it's a comedy and musical, that so have what have you. But I usually work a script the same way. I usually break it down the same way, and with scenes and beats and that sort of thing. And then I work songs like they're a monologue. So it's very similar. A musical is very similar to a play, I think. Yeah. And of course, some are comedy, some are drama. So those approaches are a little different. But yeah, I pretty much.
What kind of sneak preview can you give me? Because I know often the sets in Arts Live are very inventive and very cool. What sort of effects will we see?
Mark Landon Smith is the master of creating so many great, fabulous looks. I think the thing that I'm the most impressed with in this particular production is the amount of color that we're going to see, because we've got all this underwater action, and then we have a lot that's, of course, on land. But I think the color, to me, is going to be, and the energy, is the most exciting.
How do you achieve the underwater, or is that a...
You'll have to come and see. Yeah, it really is it's really fun. It's really a fun effect. And it's very simple. It's a very simple effect. And I don't want to give it away.
Julie Gable, the director of The Little Mermaid Jr. at Arts Live, speaking just before rehearsal last night in Fayetteville. The performances are May 9th through the 12th. Tickets and much more information available at artslivetheater.com.
Watch out from that, or you'll go to your room in mysterious fathoms below.
Before we end our monthly checklist of theater, there are a few more events to note. Sager Creek Art Center in Siloam Springs continues its comeback with the final two performances of Tender Lies, Friday and Saturday nights at the Art Center in downtown Siloam. Shows both nights are at 7:30. The popular children's book, We're Going on a Bear Hunt, hits the stage at Walton Art Center for one day and one day only, May 12th at 2 in the afternoon. And the beloved stage adaptation of War Horse is at Walton Art Center May 22nd through the 26th. Information about the Bear Hunt or War Horse available at waltonartcenter.org. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kelms. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is John Jetter. He is the conductor and musical director for the Fort Smith Symphony. Welcome back.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. We are talking about the conclusion of the current season.
Amazing, isn't it?
It is.
It's gone by very, very quickly. We have a final concert on Saturday evening, May 4th.
I'm going to make a prediction. No one will sleep through this one. Not that they sleep through any of them anyway, but...
What? Wait a minute.
But what I'm saying is this one would be very difficult to sleep.
Yes. This is on Saturday, May 4th at 7:30 p.m. at the Arkansas Best Corporation Performing Arts Center. And the reason you're saying that is you saw the title. The title of the concert is called Sonic Boom. So there you have it.
Yes.
We are performing the just great, maybe, I don't want to say the greatest march ever written, although it kind of is. It's this terrific piece by William Walton. It's his Crown Imperial March, which was written in 1937 for the coronation of King George the VI. Is that right? Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's just a blockbuster, huge-scale march. Very brilliant, very exciting. Kind of typical William Walton, kind of driven but regal. One of his most well-known pieces. He wrote Belshazzar's Feast, and there's a very famous viola concerto. I love his first symphony. So we open with that, and then we go to the second suite of music from Daphnis and Chloe by Maurice Ravel.
Yes.
It's the final 18 minutes or so that comes from the complete ballet of Daphnis and Chloe. It's considered Ravel's greatest work, greatest orchestral work, and we'll be joined by the UA Fort Smith University Chorale. They will be singing with us, but they won't be singing any words. It's all ahs and oohs and da's, D-A. And Ravel uses the chorus in this work completely as atmosphere. And this is it's the final scene. It's the big climactic part of the ballet where Daphnis and Chloe sort of dance this pantomime retelling the story of Pan and Syrinx. And it's a love story, and then all of the dancers come in dressed as pirates and buccaneers, and they have this crazy dance, and the piece ends. It's a fantastic work. We take intermission, and then after intermission, we perform the Clarinet Concerto by Aaron Copland. It's right up there with Mozart. It's in the top two of great clarinet concertos. Our soloist is Dr. David Carter. He is the clarinet instructor at UA Fort Smith. He's the principal clarinetist of the Tulsa Symphony. He also performs with us in the orchestra from time to time. And that is a fantastic piece. It was commissioned for $2,000.
Hmm.
Commissioned by Benny Goodman.
Yes.
For Copland to write. It took a while to Copland to get around to it. And it's a beautiful, it's in two movements. The first movement is one of the most beautiful adagio movements ever written. And then things go jazzy on us, and it gets into very spiky, almost dissonant 40s era jazz. And it's a beautiful piece. It's for clarinet, and the orchestra is strings, harp, and piano.
I wonder what kind of conversation went on between Benny Goodman and Aaron Copland, because that's two of the sharpest musical minds of the last century.
Well, I know that after the piece was written and Benny Goodman looked at it, there were a few things that he didn't like in it.
Hmm.
And he had to sort of go back hat in hand to Mr. Copland and say, well, which I'm sure was very awkward.
Yeah.
When the piece was commissioned, Goodman really didn't say much. I want you to write a concerto. Just go for it. But I do want, from the time that you start working on it, I do want exclusive rights to perform it for about 2 years or something like that. But what happened is, for whatever reason, Goodman was a busy guy, kept
right.
stalling, and pretty soon the 2 years was almost up. So there was a little bit of tension there, and Copland kept saying, you know, I got other people who are interested in playing the piece. Let's get it done.
Get on the stick, Benny.
So, but they ended up later on performing it many times together. They recorded it together twice, and it's a beautiful work written in 1947-48. And then after that, we close with the Pines of Rome.
Yes.
And it doesn't get any better than that. What a beautiful piece. And yes, it's about pine trees in various places in Rome. There's the first movement, the Via Borghese, is you hear children playing soldiers and marching. And then the second movement is a really mysterious pine trees near the catacombs. And then the third movement is the pines near of the Janiculum. And that's the very famous moment where I think he's was the first composer to actually incorporate a recording into a performance. Mm. And he wanted to hear a certain kind of bird.
Right.
And there's
if you've ever heard it, you know.
Yeah,
exactly
you know what you're talking
is.
About. So and there's this very specific recording. You can't just use any bird recording. You have to use a specific one. And then of course the last one went Pines of the Appian Way. We'll have members of the UA Fort Smith Symphonic Band performing also because there are requirements for extra brass players at the end.
Will you have a recording of the bird?
Yeah, it's now on CD. But so, in the old days, I mean, you would actually, when the music would come, yes, you would get an LP.
Mm-hmm. So that means that somebody behind, I mean, in the box.
So I got it. Yeah, I got a cue. I got to cue somebody.
Wow.
Yes.
So you're going to be, for this piece, you'll be conducting front and back of hall.
Yeah. Or maybe the side. Maybe I'll give Becky a cue and then she'll,
gotcha.
She'll. Not many tickets for this concert. And I think it's a great way to end the season. Tickets are available at the Symphony box office at 452-7575. FortSmithSymphony.org will give you more information about the concert. But I think it's quite a bit.
Yes. And this closes the current season, but you already know what you're doing for the next.
Yes. The week of the April 20th concert, subscribers will have been sent their new season brochure for next year. And, of course, next season's real special. It's the orchestra's 90th anniversary, so we've got a really big season planned.
Just give me one word that would give us a hint of what's in that 90th season.
One word.
Yeah, just to tease us.
Huge.
Okay.
Large scale.
Okay, all right.
I'll give you a sentence. Are we really going to be able to fit everyone on stage?
That sounds exciting.
There you go.
Okay. Thank you, John.
All right.
John Jetter is the conductor and music director of the Fort Smith Symphony. The Fayetteville Foam Fest will be held this Saturday, May 4th from 5 until 8 p.m. in Walton Arts Center parking lot in Fayetteville. This Feed Fayetteville fundraiser will feature beers and tastings from over 50 breweries, food, and more. Tickets and more information online at FayettevilleFoamFest.com. And support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Golden City.
Aha, where is Golden City?
South of Boonville.
There you go. Very good.
Now, before we go, we've got a couple of tickets to give away today, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Coming home to the mountain, an evening with Crow Johnson and Still on the Hill will be Saturday at Ozark Folkways, and we have a pair of tickets. In order to do that, we need an answer to a trivia question.
Earlier, there was a music bed, and it was inspired by the play Meet Me in St. Louis, mm-hmm. which was inspired by a World's Fair in St. Louis. Tell me what year the World's Fair in St. Louis opened.
Okay, and it was on this date.
It was on this date in that year.
In that year. So closest one to the year wins. You can email us the year at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. And we will announce the winner tomorrow on Ozarks at Large.
And you don't have to come here to get the tickets. We'll call in Winslow for you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. What year did the St. Louis Fair open?
Yes, sir.
Arkansas Razorbacks play Missouri State tonight at Baum Stadium, the last non-conference game of the regular season. First pitch at 6:30.
Okay. Yeah. Didn't you want to ask me something about baseball last week?
Did you see, we have a little bit of time here, did you see the strange play that happened with the Milwaukee Brewers where a runner was on first, stole second, then ends up back on first? It had never happened before.
I wasn't sure what happened. I saw it on SportsCenter's like not top 10 or something for the mm-hmm. Friday, and I was half paying attention because I was getting ready for work, and I didn't quite figure out what happened.
Base runner at first, he steals second.
Uh-huh.
Then the next batter walks, so you have runners at first and second. And the base runner who had originally stolen second then starts to steal third.
Mm-hmm.
But he takes off before the pitchers release the ball. He gets caught in a rundown.
Right.
He starts to go back to second. The trailing runner who had been at first is already at second. That's what you're supposed to do, so you still have a runner in scoring position. Both runners end up at second.
Right.
The second baseman didn't know who to tag because only one player can occupy the base. He tags them both. The lead runner thinks he's the one out, so he's trotting back to the dugout, which is on the first base side. By the time he gets to first, he realizes, no, he wasn't out. He gets to first, and he's safe. Now, I know what you're thinking.
That's hilarious.
What about the Germany Schaefer rule of the 1920s when Germany Schaefer intentionally stole first?
Uh-huh.
No, that doesn't apply here because he was not, this base runner was not intentionally trying to confuse the base runners.
Right.
So he ended up at first. Then he tried to steal second again and was thrown out. There is no way to score this in the scorebook. This blew collective baseball minds last week. Fantastic. You watch the game, you never know what's going to happen. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Carreta.
Thanks for listening.